From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, award-winning journalist Gary Young talks about his latest book, Another Day in the Death of America, and actress Felicity Huffman talks about her role in the show American Crime. But first, 25 years ago, the acquittal of three white Los Angeles police officers in the beating of motorist Rodney King led to protest and the civil disobedience known as the LA riots, or LA rebellion, if you prefer. Has the city recovered? I'll discuss this and more with four leaders who were around during those critical days. Congresswoman Karen Bass, she co-founded the Community Coalition in 1990 and eventually became the first African-American female speaker of the California Assembly. Gil Garcetti, who was elected L.A. County's new D.A. just weeks after the verdict. Former L.A. City Councilman Mike Wu, he was a candidate in the 1993 mayoral race. He's now the dean of the College of Environmental Design at Cal Poly Pomona. And John Mack, the former president of the L.A. Urban League and the L.A. Police Commission. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Does it seem like 25 years, John Mack?
No, you know, it's actually incredible. I mean, the years have just jumped by. It seems like it was maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but 25. But, of course, it still burns in my mind, the whole memory and the whole process it went through. Of course, on the day of that verdict, a bunch of us, as you well know, had gathered over at First AME Church to await the verdict. And after seeing that videotape, it was hard for us to believe that that jury was going to make the decision they made, but they did. And, of course, we know the results.
Yeah. Congresswoman Bass, there are a lot of people who will look at this anniversary and go back to that singular and, indeed, pivotal moment in this country, for that matter, in the nation's history. And yet there was so much happening in this city prior to that, that one has to go back beyond that week or that day or that year or even 5 years to get a sense of the powder keg that Los Angeles was. Yes or no?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that it's really important not to view it from just the simplistic fashion of the verdict, because if you look at what happened over those 3 days of the civil unrest and you look at who participated in the looting, you saw that it was really, to me, what I call the rainbow revolt. Mm-hmm. It happened all over the city. It wasn't just in South LA. Every type of person was involved. And I think it showed a lot of the social and economic distress that the city was under, period.
Gil Garcetti, you were running for office during this time. What do you recall about running for office in the midst of this tension where we were awaiting this verdict?
I remember when the riot started. And I'm driving back from a campaign event, and we're hearing what's going on at Florence and Normandy. And I said, Florence and Normandy, that's Art's Chili Dog. This is my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. This is where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I'm waiting. Well, the police are going to be responding soon, quickly. And the news reports continue to come, and there wasn't any police response. I said, where the hell's LAPD? How can this? They can't ignore this. This can get out of hand very quickly. That was the tension that I personally felt, that LAPD was not doing the job that we expected them to do.
Yeah. Mike, what do you recall about that that unrest that existed between the Asian community and the African American community?
Well, there was a lot of tension going on between Korean Americans mm-hmm. and African Americans specifically. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to meetings and events in the community where the rage that African Americans felt about being dispossessed, not owning places like stores in the community, came out very loudly. And yet, from the point of view of the immigrants, they felt they were being unfairly targeted. Mm-hmm. And so this was brewing for a long time. And of course, the shooting of Latasha Harlins, other incidents took place. But the Rodney King incident and the condoning of police misconduct was what, for me, as a member of the city council, really opened my eyes and made me realize that people have to speak up and make a difference.
Yeah. Congresswoman Bass, you certainly recall this. We all do. Most of you know I worked for Tom Bradley when he was the mayor of this city, and the tension between Tom Bradley and Daryl Gates, the police chief at that time, could not have been more heightened.
Right. Absolutely. I think that's right. And Daryl Gates and his legacy, I mean, you know, it was really awful. It's funny if you think about it today, mm-hmm. because we see police shootings on video and cell phone camera, you know, unfortunately, rather routinely. Mm-hmm. But to me, I saw the police lack of response as Daryl Gates punishing the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was off at a fundraiser.
That's right.
And I happened to be right at Florence and Normandy when it happened, mm-hmm. not even knowing. I drove into the intersection at the time when people were beginning to throw bricks into cars. Had no idea. Looked up in the sky and saw all these helicopters. Thought they were police helicopters.
Right.
They were news helicopters.
That's right. And I actually agree with Karen. I mean, I think that it was a deliberate act on Daryl Gates' part not to respond, to that incident, in contrast, you know, to the 1965 event. And Tavis, even though I moved here in 1969, but mm-hmm. as I reflect upon what happened in 1965, suppose what happened, during the in response to the jury verdict and King beating, and you look at other incidents
sure.
around the country, the thing that triggers these incidents is always a confrontation between the police
right.
and the community, based upon years. And I agree with Karen, we have to be careful not to be overly simplistic, but no doubt about it, as I see, it was like a volcano that had been building mm-hmm. and building. The obvious LAPD acting like an operation force in our community, mm-hmm. and quite frankly, the majority community sort of turning their heads. Mm-hmm. The videotape highlighted that, in my opinion. But beyond that, you had other issues. Jobs,
right.
education, no supermarkets. All of these things just sort of came, but the spark yeah. seems to always be that tension between the
Tell me, John Mack, how do you think it got, how did it get so bad? And I ask that because L.A. did have a black mayor for 20 years
yeah.
and Tom Bradley. Tom Bradley had mm-hmm. been a high-ranking police officer.
Yeah.
There were mm-hmm. there were members of color on the L.A. City Council who had some authority and some clout mm-hmm. and some control. So how did LAPD get so out of control? Why were they treating people of color, certainly black people, so punitively and pejoratively?
Well, I think one reason,
yeah.
Daryl Gates had civil service protection.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Going back, you know, exactly. William Parker, who cleaned up the old corruption. Mm-hmm. The city charter was changed so that he was untouchable. He operated like a J. Edgar Hoover at
right.
the local level. He mm-hmm. could thumb his nose at Tom Bradley. He could thumb his nose at the or the DA.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me that was one of the important yeah. issues here, because you're right. I mean, there was a real dysfunction between yeah. Daryl Gates and Mayor Bradley. But frankly, Gates could just basically thumb his nose.
What do we recall, Gil Garcetti, about the way the white community in L.A. saw this, what their expectations were of what this verdict would have been?
Well, I think you raised the most interesting issue there, because I don't see it so much as LAPD versus anyone. Mm-hmm. I see it as a justice issue that there, you and I have talked about this once before, that in the black community, they view justice in terms, is it black justice or is it white justice? Because those two are not always the same. Here, I think the outrage was not directed right at LAPD. It was directed at the justice system, that this system permitted these culpable officers to be acquitted. There was outrage, and an outrage comes from generations, not just who's alive right now today, but the outrage that the justice system will treat a black person differently than they would a white person. If you had reversed this, had it been four black officers and a white victim, what would have happened there? Any doubt there would have been guilty verdicts?
Michael, we did end up with a black police chief. After we got past the Daryl Gates era, we ended up with a black police chief in L.A. I've had a couple, quite frankly. But in that racially tinged mayoral race that I referenced earlier, introducing mm-hmm. you couldn't quite make it happen. To what extent, in retrospect, do you think that your campaign was impacted by the feelings that were still lingering in this city?
Well, it's hard to think back 25 years, Tavis,
yeah.
but I think there was a lot of racial tension in the air that continued after 1992 that affected the citywide elections. I couldn't really see it coming, but I think that there were a lot of lessons that came out of that early period in the early 90s about race relations and the relationship between political leadership and a police department that still, I think, bear very strong, have a lot of insight for what's going on in LA today. I don't think we're on the verge of any kind of riot, but I think, as others could point out, it doesn't take that much to ignite a riot. And the same kind of violence that's taken place in other cities, I think potentially could happen in LA again if there was the same combination of ingredients that we had in the early 90s.
But for the fact that we had a chief come here, Bill Bratton, who I think changed the culture of that's LAPD, right. Not only hired more minorities, but many women, put women in higher command positions, started working with the community, said, all right, we're here to help, let's talk. It's the first time that had ever been done. Instead of the arms folded, we're the boss, no one can touch me, be Daryl Gates or a person in blue. That changed dramatically. It's not perfect. LAPD, no law enforcement agency, is really the ideal agency right now, because there's still so much work to be done, because there's so many kids and others who either drop out of school, don't have jobs. It's the poverty issue.
And yet, Congressman Bass, I could fill this studio if I'd wanted to with residents of this city who still feel 25 years later that on a number of different fronts, not the least of which would be civilian control of the police department, community-based policing. I can do this all day. There are many people who still feel that we haven't made the progress that we ought to have made 25 years later.
Right. I mean, I think that's correct. Yeah. I do think that things have changed, but I do think that there's a lot further to go. And I agree with you completely in terms of the culture change. But I do think that there's some great examples that need to be implemented in communities that would even resolve the tension all the more. But I do have to mention one thing. You got, Mike Wu got the majority of the African-American vote. Right. And I think that's really important, because when we look back at 25 years, to cast it as African Americans versus Asians, and then 2 minutes later you get the majority of the black vote, says something.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you for being there 25 years ago. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Here's a disturbing statistic. On average, 7 children or teenagers are killed with guns every day in America. My next guest, Gary Young, decided to put a human face on what he calls the collateral damage of this statistic, and his latest text, Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. He's also a commentator for The Nation magazine and the editor-at-large for The Guardian newspaper, where he has been reporting on European politics. Gary, good to have you on the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, James.
Let me start across the pond, and then we'll come back to the text here, stateside. First of all, the French elections, what do you make of the interim outcome? It's not quite over yet.
No.
But Marie Le Pen comes in second, not first.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, well, first of all, there's the Le Pen factor.
Yeah. Now,
I studied French. I studied in France.
Right.
When I was 15 and following a school exchange, I went out to visit one of the kids that I was become friends with. Mm-hmm. Second day I was there, he came into my room with a tent and he and tears in his eyes. And his father said I couldn't stay in the house anymore. He didn't want a black man in the house. And it was this weird, it was more traumatic for him actually than it was for me, but I was kicked out of the house. I was 15, hadn't done anything. This was my summer holiday. I had to wait for my mum to send me some money. That year, 84, Le Pen's father gets 8% of the vote. And the whole of France is like, oh my God, what on earth has gone on? What's happened? 8%. Then you fast forward 33 years and his daughter, Marine Le Pen, is on about 22-23%, and people are feeling like, whoo, she didn't win. She didn't win, and she probably won't win the second round, and we really dodged a bullet. And so you get a sense, I think, from those two stories of how the far right in Europe, which is now fascism is a mainstream ideology in Europe, it's like arsenic in the water supply. It's in there, and it's hell to get it out once it's in there, and it has a foothold. Now, I don't think it's a dominant foothold. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we're in a very volatile time. You know, Brexit, Trump. Sure. You don't want to make too many predictions. It's unlikely that she will win the second round because France still has living memory and hard in the consciousness the experience of fascism on its soil, and you know, Nazi Germany and so on. But nonetheless, it's clear that it's not going anywhere, and that's troubling. And in that sense, in the sense that the hard right is on the march, Holland, Britain, France, Germany to a lesser extent. I think one way of understanding it for Americans is to say that everywhere has a Trump. Mm. And actually, in many ways, Trump is a latecomer to this party. This has been going on for a while. And to that extent, America is not exceptional. In fact, this is where we are right now. Although what is exceptional is that he won the whole thing. Mm. Although one could make comparisons between him and Silvio Berlusconi, a big businessman, very kind of mercurial character. Sure. But the other thing about these elections, which was interesting, was that while the centrist candidate, the center-right candidate, center-left candidate, rather, of the, what in France is the Socialist Party, but it'd be more like the Democratic Party here, while their vote collapsed, Mélenchon, hard left, higher taxes, a kind of appealing to the white working class, among others, he did really well. So
sounds like Bernie.
Right. So
and sounds most like Bernie, yeah.
Most European countries also have a Bernie.
Yeah.
France, Germany, once again to a lesser extent, Britain with Corbyn, Greece, Portugal. And so you have these two countervailing responses to the anxiety around neoliberal globalization.
The question is it enough? It wasn't enough to stave off a Trump victory here. So is that other approach, that other alternative, enough?
Not yet.
No,
it's not yet. Yeah. And in a few places it's done well. Portugal and Greece has done well. But I think what's important in this moment, where there's a lot of despair everywhere, is at least to realize that there is a response out there, and it is gaining an audience. It hasn't broken through yet in many places, but for people who think, you know, what is going to stop this, there is energy out there, and it's finding its place.
You mentioned Britain and Brexit a couple of times now, so let me jump from France to Britain. So Theresa May has decided that she wants early elections. She's trying to shore up her support so she can engage the Brexit conversation the way she wants to. Tell me what we need to be paying attention to regarding that election and what you expect to happen there.
With that same caveat about volatility, I would expect that she would she will probably win the election. I think this election is really not going to make a whole lot of difference to the substantive issue, which is that Britain has decided to leave the European Union. It now has nothing to negotiate with, actually. It's, before it could say, if you don't do this, we're going to leave. But once you're out the door, well, so, and it's about to find out what a small country it is. You know, they used to say the sun never set on the British Empire. You know, my parents, from Barbados, they came to Britain with British passports. You know, there was, that's not the country that we live in anymore. Scotland may leave, so we should look at, you should be looking out for Scotland. And the other thing to look out for, and I don't know how this is going to play out, is the fortunes of the Labour Party. So you have to imagine that Bernie won the nomination, and then kind of imagine how that might have played out here, with elements of the Democratic Party trying to undermine him, trying to snipe at him. Bernie's shortcomings, which did exist, then being kind of on full display. How he might have done, and if he had then lost to Trump, what the conclusions might have been. And so in Britain, Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party. They spent a year trying to undermine him because he's a left winger, to dismiss him, to claim that he was hopeless. They forced another election and he won with an even greater majority. And chances are, a bit like what we were saying earlier, it might not be enough to fade off. Labour might even do quite poorly. If you spend a year fighting with your own people, you know, things might not go so well. And he's not infallible. He's made mistakes. So the other thing to watch out for is how well or badly the Labour Party do and what conclusions are drawn from that.
Yeah. It's always fascinating for me to have conversations with you, Gary, or people who study these elections around the world to see the parallels, the similarities, the differences between how it's done here, how it's done there. And what you really find and discover is, as you've already said, there's a Trump everywhere, there's a Bernie everywhere, there's somebody in the middle everywhere. The similarities are just mind-boggling to me sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I watched this election. I spent the month of the election in a small town in Indiana called Muncie for the whole time.
I grew up about 30 miles away from there.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. So I was in Muncie, Middletown, they called it. But I was watching the election through Brexit eyes. Mm-hmm. I'd just been through this. And so every time I said, well, Trump couldn't possibly win. And people couldn't. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I'd never say never. And before you start talking about this new normal, let's think about what this old normal was. Muncie lost a quarter of its manufacturing, a whole load of jobs, I had a great time there. The people were very warm, but they were struggling. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it looked like when it came through, the story of the election, which was turnout was down. The white working class in Muncie switched to Trump, but not by much. Mm-hmm. They'd voted for Obama twice. Mm-hmm. And the margins in the wealthier bits of Muncie went way up, which seemed like kind of the story of the country in a way.
Yeah, I talked to a number of my friends back in my home state of Indiana and in other parts of the Midwest. Mm. And they were telling me months before this election ever happened that Trump was going to win. Mm. So much of it was about being in the right place and seeing at ground zero what was happening. Yeah. And sometimes on the margins in New York and LA, we just don't get it. Well, so we think Hillary's going to win, but you're not in the middle of the country to see what,
I mean, it really did, both of those elections in different ways, really broke open to me the kind of, the flaws in a journalistic culture which is too white, too coastal, too rich, and therefore too kind of disconnected, and therefore after a while believes its own assumptions. It makes these assertions, and then on the basis of these assertions, then it makes a series of conclusions which form the basis for new assertions, and that there's no real response for getting out there and actually talking to people, but that in the absence of that, reality will intrude, and when it intrudes, it will intrude in a kind of, in a very upsetting manner quite often. Yeah. And that was also the same for Corbyn.
Yeah.
You know, when Corbyn won the Labour Party, when the left, just like, well, this is ridiculous, and you say, well, obviously not to a large number of people who voted for him. So let's go find out what they think. If I had a criticism of the media, not necessarily the American media, but certainly, wherever it is, it's that they have to escape their own, the trap of kind of believing that they really know what's going on.
It's arrogance. I was going to say, the only word that you didn't put on your list with rich and white is arrogance. There is an arrogance in our business that we don't want to face. Mm. And so, as I've said 1,000 times on this show, not just an arrogance, but also we know there's greed. There's just greed that we make money coming and going. So you make money building Trump up, and now you try to make money tearing him down. It's just It's the way the business works, but you've been at this longer than I have, so you understand that. Let me switch now to your text. So thank you for taking those questions. I really want to get your perspective on what's happening around the globe. Another day in the death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. Can I just say, first of all, the way that you went about framing this text was beautiful. I don't know if I've ever read a book that was framed in the way you framed the chapters.
Well,
say a word about what you did for those who haven't read it as yet and why you did that.
Well, the book is based on a very simple and really brutal statistic. Mm-hmm. Every day in America, 7 children or teens are shot dead. So I decided to pick a day at random and find out who these kids are. Most of them pass without much mention, mm-hmm. either locally and certainly not nationally. And so I spent 2 years finding out who these kids, their teachers, their preachers, their parents, anyone who would talk to me about them. And each child is a chapter, and I go through the day and introduce you to each child, the circumstances of their death, and where there are issues surrounding that death, then I go into that too.
Did you see the film Fruitvale Station?
Yes.
The Oscar Grant story? Yes. When I got your book, that movie came to mind. Because the movie, as you recall, put us in his space.
Yeah.
And we spent the day with Oscar Grant until he was tragically killed by the police in Oakland.
Yeah.
And so I thought about that as a parallel to this book and the way you did it, which is to take us through what that day was like for that child and give us a sense of who that person was. To your earlier point about these children, our children, passing without much fanfare, notice, or attention, what does it say about how we value or don't value the humanity of our own children? And I ask that, Gary, because we're so fond of saying the children are the future, and every politician stands on a platform and talks about the children and the future and all that. And when kids can be shot 7 to 10 a day, and there is no outrage about that, it says something to me, at least, about how we disregard their humanity.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I say when I talk about the book is that in no other Western country would this book be possible. This is a uniquely American thing, and I don't think American parents are any worse than parents anywhere else in the world. I don't think American kids are any worse than American kids in the world. So then it's something else that's going on that can be fixed if you want to fix it. And it's not a book about gun control, and I make that very clear in the beginning.
Sure.
But it is a book about what happens when you don't have gun control. And one of the things I've said to people who haven't read the book but want to come at me with the Constitution, I said to them, do you love the Constitution more than you love kids? Do you love the Second Amendment more than you love kids and your interpretation of that amendment? Because I'm British. I'm not going to argue with you about the scripture of your Constitution, but you just need to talk to me about how we keep these kids alive. And it was stunning to me in writing the book, the degree to which the black parents in the book, so 10 kids got shot dead that day, 7 are black. Every black parent in the book that I spoke to, when I asked them, did you think this could happen? To a person, they would say, well, yeah, I thought it could happen, you know. The mother in Dallas of Samuel Brightman, Audrey, she said, well, I didn't think it would be him. I thought it would be his brother. Mm-hmm. The father of Gary Anderson in Newark said, you're not doing your job properly as a black parent if you don't believe that your child could be shot dead. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm British, but I lived in America. I covered this country for 12 years. And my kids are American, African-American. My wife is African-American. And first of all, there was a realization, my son would have been 6 or 7 at the time, that I was carrying that around with me too, just in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. But secondly, that how in 2002, I interviewed Maya Angelou. It was just after the 9/11 attacks. And I asked her about those. And she said, you know, I don't want to be dodgy, but we have been living in a state of terror for several hundred years. And this was a hate crime. And I thought it was a clever thing, but I didn't fully understand it. But when I was writing this book and thinking that all of these parents are walking around in their gut, having this fear, having this anxiety, wanting to just keep their kids alive in working class black neighborhoods in particular, but not exclusively. And then I understood what she meant.
Mm-hmm. That is an arresting question that you have and continue to pose to your critics, which I want to go back to. Do you love the Constitution more than you love your children? Do you love this document more than you love your babies? When you pose that question, what kind of responses are you getting?
Well, they really don't want to talk about these kids.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to talk about their rights.
Sure, sure.
And,
So they avoid the question?
They do. They avoid the question. What they tend to do is talk about parenting. Mm-hmm. And the easiest and reflexive place for people to go with this issue is to blame the parents. Mm-hmm. And to say that, you know, the Constitution is a sacred document, and you know, when people are bad parents, well, you know, that's not the fault of the Second Amendment. I say I'm not debating the Second Amendment with you. Mm-hmm. But what I get from that is a chronic lack of empathy. They're saying it's not just that these are demographically, socioeconomically different from me, they're worse than me. Mm. The children are feral, the parents are negligent. They're saying this could never be me. And that's an entirely different proposition.
From your vantage point, when you see this radical lack of empathy in our society, tell me what you see.
First of all, I see segregation.
Okay.
And that my experience of reporting from certain areas of any city is that there are bits of cities that nobody comes out of and nobody goes to. Mm-hmm. They are chronically isolated areas, south side of Chicago, areas of the south side mm-hmm. of Chicago, or I mean every city has them. And that geographical proximity in that sense means nothing. So you can live in Chicago and not know anything about the lives of many of your fellow Chicagoans mm-hmm. because they're over there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes over there is only three or four blocks away. Mm-hmm. That's one element to this lack of empathy. Another, I think, is with the disintegration of news sources, people are getting their information from very different places. So some people are talking about are fixated on Michael Brown and the cigarillos, mm-hmm. and other people are talking about Black Lives Matter and everything else that's going on with the Ferguson mm-hmm. Police Department. And therefore, the common conversation that you need to have, not to agree, mm-hmm. but to understand, okay, that's where you're coming from. I see. So there have been times when reporting from this country where I've been to the NRA mm-hmm. or convention or to a Republican meeting or the Republican convention, and I've had conversations with people who are working off entirely different, not just the odd story or two,
sure.
but an entirely different narrative about how we got here, and you know that the source of the crash in mm-hmm. 2008 was something to do with Bill Clinton and African Americans and housing, and not to do with, like, you know, mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs and so. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think that people want easier answers mm. than exist. So one thing that happens with this book is I say, well, it's a book about 10 children and teens who got shot dead one day. And some people want to know how many were in a gang. Mm. And I want to say, well, you know, they're still kids.
Yeah.
They're still kids. And by the way, being a gang, it's not like they pay dues and hand out membership cards. It doesn't work like that. But that kind of, they want to know, are they worthy
yeah.
to have been killed, or were they unworthy?
And that's the wrong question.
It's entirely it's the wrong question.
Yeah.
One of the boys who dies in the book, the first comment after the story says, you know, well, what was he doing out so late? I would not let my kids out that late. You got to ask the parents. Then you find the parents, and you find that that night they had a family night. They drank cocoa. They watched We're the Millers. He played Uno. The worst thing Samuel Brightman did that night was cheat at Uno. Mm-hmm. He's 16 years old. He decides to walk his friend 3 minutes back to his house, and in that time he got shot. But you have this assumption below the line, first comment, I want to bet. His mother knew where he was. She just couldn't save him.
The book is called Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. Brilliant, brilliant text written by Gary Young. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Emmy and Golden Globe-winning actress Felicity Huffman's TV credits include Sports Night and the fan favorite Desperate Housewives. She now stars in the critically acclaimed ABC hit show American Crime, now in its third season. Before our conversation, here's a clip from American Crime.
I gotta figure out how to keep things going.
You need money.
I need to come home.
And all that talk about trying to find yourself, trying to breathe, and wanting to take a stand for the workers, that just goes away. What's it gonna be like when you're back?
It's gonna be like it was.
No, it won't.
I'm gonna be there for you. I will support you.
You're gonna be a housewife. The same thing that set you off before. And the minute you feel disrespected, you leave again.
That's tense.
Yeah.
Very tense.
Yeah. It's intense to watch the show.
Yeah.
It's not light entertainment, but it is entertaining.
This is a silly question, but not the first or last I will ever ask, I suspect. It is intense to watch. I mean, it's beautiful. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
But it is intense to watch. Does it feel that way when you guys are, does it feel that way on set? I mean, what's the set like?
It's an intense set.
Yeah.
Everyone's very dedicated. Everyone's sort of very professional. Some are new. Some have had years behind them. But it's very quiet.
Yeah.
It's very on purpose. There's not a lot of like, hey, let's hang out and play.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's focused.
Yeah. How does that impact your work on screen when you are going to undertake a task as a thespian that is purposeful?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Purposeful sort of in the social conversation. I think as an actor, your job is always to find what it is in that story, in that person's character story, that you can endorse.
Mm-hmm.
And in something like this, this episode, this season deals with slavery and forced labor, modern day slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So much of that is about not having agency in the world, not having a voice, having no traction. And in a very minor way, the character that I play, Jeanette Hesby, that is also true of her too. You know, she's been a good housewife for 24, 25 years, and she has, there's no me in the us of the marriage, and she doesn't have a bank account in her name. She can't get it. She never signed for a car loan. She has no way to make money. And I think she discovers that she is also helpless, and she cannot help others because of her own. She's ineffectual, ineffectualness.
John Ridley was here just last week.
Oh, John Ridley.
Bragging about you and how much he loves you and how great an actress you are and what a great team member you are. And I told him you were going to be here this week, and he was all excited about that. So I'm glad to have you back this
week. Was he wearing a gray sweatshirt?
He was,
okay,
pretty much.
That's
the same John Ridley. he doesn't get dressed up except for the Academy Awards.
Yeah, that's right.
Other than that, that's John. So I'm. But the conversation was brilliant.
And I
was whispering to you before when you came on. We've gotten so much response to that conversation with John because John has this way, you know him well because you work with him every day, but he has this way in conversation of almost being poetic.
He almost talks like he writes, and you can see why his writing is so good, because he just talks that way in conversation. So at the end of the conversation, I'm running to my room to write down like 8 one-liners that he used that were really good.
Oh, I know. I finally, after 3 years, when we go up and do press and we have, you know, round tables or we're up on stage, when John talks, I bring up my cell phone and I just hit record because I really like to go back.
That's funny.
He's just a genius. He's just really smart and very thoughtful, and he talks as if he already wrote down the answer.
Exactly. Which leads me to ask, after 3 years of working with him and doing these very, here's that word, intense again, these very intense subjects that you guys tackled every season. What's been your takeaway from that? I mean, what are you learning about the world, about life, about yourself? I don't want to color the question too much, but it just seems to me that if you're doing work that is that real and surreal, you know, year after year, that it must be changing you in some sort of way.
Impacting
you in some sort of way.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's impacting me in a lot of ways. The first is the takeaway that I've taken from all 3 years is the interconnectivity of all of us and the cascade effect of our actions, and that we are not alone. Everything we do affects everyone else. And a lot of the times we're unconscious about it. This year particularly, you know, forced labor. I didn't realize that, you know, picking up a tomato and what has gone into that tomato and what it takes. And the other thing that I've taken away from it is I really admire television to back, particularly network television, to back thoughtful, deep, tough, true stories that they want to take it. And I think that takes courage. And finally, something that I think John Ridley does brilliantly, and I've learned about it, is the stories behind the story. You know, there's a crime or there's something explosive and we read about it in the headlines and we go, oh, well, so that happened. And no, it didn't just happen. Now the story begins, the cascade effect of how it affects all those lives. And that I didn't know about. And even this season, when I look at those camps that, you know, that we shot at or that we recreated, I went, oh my God, is this what it's like? You know, it's the brilliance of storytelling that you actually get to walk in someone else's shoes and go, I didn't know that was the experience. So those shots of them walking across the desert, you know, the illegal immigrants, I went, oh my God, is that what it's like?
Yeah. Speaking of storytelling, what's your feeling, your takeaway 3 years later of the way this story is told versus other series you've done? This is not sort of episodic. It's kind of long. I mean, the story's told over the course of the season.
Season 3,
yeah. So have you come to like the way this particular show is shot? Are you?
Well, you know, John keeps a lot of stuff from us. You're right. Season 1 and 2, there was an inciting incident, and then it sort of explodes out from there, and we follow the treads, the threads of it all. And this season, I kept going, how are all these stories interconnected? What is going on? What can I have in common with Lily Taylor and Tim, or Regina's storyline, or Richard Cabral? And I thought, oh, maybe there is no sort of coming together. There is no body of all the tentacles. And it wasn't, because he redacts a lot of the scripts and he doesn't let you know what's going, that it wasn't until the last episode where I went, oh, that's what it means.
Yeah.
And as an actor, it's kind of fantastic because you're not, you know, I'm not playing the end of the scene at the beginning or the end of the season at the beginning.
That could be a bit worrisome to me to not know where this thing is going.
It totally is worrisome, and thank God I trust John Ridley and Michael McDonald so implicitly. Yeah. But there were times when I'd show up on set, and because the last episode, so much had been redacted, that I'd come on going, what do I know? What happened last? And they'd have to explain it to me because I didn't get to read the scenes. But it does make you be on your toes, and it is scary in the sense that I go, I hope this is correct. I hope I don't have to change courses next episode.
Yeah. I just saw Felicity on the cover of a gorgeous magazine.
You enjoy those photo shoots?
I guess
women are different. I guess
terrifying.
You guys love that stuff.
No.
I hate you.
Yeah, all you do is sort of go, I'm not worthy. And then the photographer's sitting there going, fantastic, lovely. And inside you're going, I bet you hate this. I'm so sorry you have to shoot me. Yeah.
And in the end, you're in love with it.
Yeah, in the end, you're like, yeah, that's totally what I look like.
Every day,
I'm
huh?
Not.
You wake up that way, huh?
That's right. I woke up like this.
How is your wonderful husband doing?
He is fantastic. Yeah, he's got a little break. He directed 3 movies in 4 years. Oh my God, it just about killed him.
Yeah.
And finally the family was like, could you take a break? Because you're super grumpy. Yeah. And now he has a break and he's relaxing and he goes back to season 8 of Shameless.
Is it 8 now?
Yeah, and it's just getting better and better. So he's pretty swell. He's doing the honey-do list.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You're like, oh yeah.
We all know what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. not that you shouldn't be this fortunate, but you guys are on a. You guys have had a good run.
Oh my God.
That is Woody.
Yeah.
And both of you.
I know.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you must feel like blessed, fortunate. You tell me. But the two of you, you two just stay busy.
Thank you, God.
And on great shows, not even mediocre shows.
I know. We are so, yes, I feel very blessed. Yeah. I feel very grateful. I literally walk through my day going, wow, it couldn't, as good as it gets. Yeah, it doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah.
And I'm totally in love with them. And I love our girls who are 15 and 16. And I'm actually loving teenage years.
Yeah.
I don't know how, but I am. And I couldn't be luckier. Thank you, God.
You should give your website out. Because we're going to get a bunch of phone calls from parents like, wait, she has a 15 and 16-year-old kid, and she's loving this?
I am.
They're going to want some advice.
Well, I have a website, What the Flicka. It's called whattheflicka.com.
There
and it
go.
Started just because I needed some help parenting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, go to What the Flicka if you want to know how the Flicka she's doing it. And Felicity can answer those questions for you, because anybody that's parenting teens and is like, loving it is got some advice to offer. Good to see you as always.
Nice to see
my
you.
Best
Thank
to your
you
husband.
So much.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.